Greece jumps, Spain slumps. From APM American Public Media, I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Memorial Day, Monday, May 28th. Coming up, the sinking cost of olive oil and how to help out on Memorial Day, plus the growing market for Asian air travel. That's just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Markets in Europe are mixed today. Greece is way up. Spain is down. We've got Austin Hughes with us to make sense of it all. He's chief economist at KBC Bank in Ireland. Good morning, Austin.
Good morning.
So why are Greek markets cheering today?
I think they've been buoyed by a couple of opinion polls over the weekend that show pro-austerity parties making some gains. Now, I think it's still far too early to suggest that the election is going to deliver a government that will be able to deliver further austerity. But I think the sense that maybe the Greek electorate are having second thoughts about the rejection of all things European is making Greek markets that little bit more optimistic.
So now let's move on to Spain. Why are markets there down?
Well, the contrast in terms of Greece and Spain is very significant. In the case of Greece, I think it is clear that people feel, well, we know how awful it could get, even if no one is exactly sure what life outside the euro might be like. In Spain, however, there is a banking crisis and an economic crisis. And with each passing day, we get new estimates of the scale of the banking crisis. The new estimates from Bankia in terms of the amount that it's going to require from the government are unsettling markets. The uncertainty about the scale of the banking problems, and I suppose the uncertainty about the pace with which they're being addressed, is causing a lot of nervousness in Spain.
Austin Hughes is chief economist at KBC Bank in Ireland. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Good morning.
For more on Spain's troubled banks, including Bankia, which needs about $24 billion in new capital, reporter Christopher Worth joins us from London. Good morning, Christopher.
Hey, good morning, Adrian.
So catch us up here. Why is Bankia in so much trouble?
Well, first of all, I should say that Bankia is big. I mean, it's Spain's third largest bank, and it's sitting on about $40 billion worth of toxic assets. You know, Spain experienced a housing boom and bust that's kind of similar to what the U.S. experienced. The difference with Spain is that a lot of bad Spanish home loans were made by these smaller Spanish regional banks called Cajas, and they all held so many bad loans that the government encouraged them to merge into a bigger bank, this bank that we're calling Bankia. But the danger in merging several small bad banks is that you can end up with a big bad bank, as is the case with Bankia.
And so when the financial crisis unfolded here in the U.S., Washington spent a lot of money backstopping banks. Is that what Spain is doing here?
Well, yes, in a sense. I mean, this is Spain getting around to doing what the U.S. government did earlier and what Spain has really tried to avoid doing up until now. I mean, the problem is how to pay for it, right? I mean, by all estimates, Spain does not have the kind of money it needs to do this. But I spoke with Javier Diaz Jimenez at IESE Business School in Madrid, and he says most likely Spain is going to need some kind of rescue from its European neighbors.
It will not be a spectacular rescue like the Greek or the Portuguese or the Irish rescues, but Spain will need money from the European institutions to recapitalize its banking system.
But he does think Spain is on the right track with Bankia.
Thanks so much, Christopher.
Hey, thanks, Adrian.
And as if Europe didn't have enough on its plate, it's now facing a big drop in the price of olive oil, one of its biggest exports. From London, the BBC's John Bithrie explains how the drop could take a bite out of economies that are already in trouble.
Europeans spend a lot of money on olive oil for their cooking, but with an economic recession creeping across the continent, many here are spending less on cooking and expensive cooking oils than in years past. And with less demand, the price of olive oil is at its lowest level since 2002. That's been a double whammy for some of the hardest hit countries in Europe. 70% of the world's olive oil supply comes from Spain, Greece and Italy. Pekka Pesonen is with Europe's main farming union.
Thanks to the crisis, people do not consume olive oil that much, especially in other European countries, or they switch to cheaper varieties.
Spanish olive farmers have also been enjoying some of the best growing weather in years, so the country is producing even more olive oil than normal, flooding the market with cheaper bottles. That's making matters even worse for farmers across Europe. The European Union has plans to prop up the price farmers get, buying up 100,000 tonnes to put into storage and release later. They're also planning a new promotional campaign to get people to use more olive oil in their dinners. But in the meantime, it's another threat to jobs in economies that are already in deep trouble. In London, I'm the BBC's John Bithrie for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Turns out Chinese business people are traveling more and more. By 2015, they'll be the top business travel spenders in the world. That's according to a new study by the Global Business Travel Association. And there are a lot of reasons for it. New airports, more spending, and the growing popularity of air travel in Asia. As Needy Dutt reports from Jakarta, Indonesia, the trend extends well beyond business execs.
While budget carriers are struggling to make money in the United States and Europe, airports across Southeast Asia have never been busier. From the Philippines to Thailand to Indonesia, many millions of passengers are checking in and taking off. And many of those passengers, like 28-year-old Noor Rami in Jakarta, are flying for the very first time.
At first I was excited, and then when I got to the airport I was really nervous, and when I got at the plane I was terrifying.
Noor is part of Asia's growing middle class, a group that with rising wages can now afford modern luxuries like air travel. And besides the simple fact of more money, more infrastructure spending by governments means more roads and cars. That's allowed small towns across Southeast Asia to grow better connected to urban airports. Eri Reksa Projo is with a Jakarta-based firm that is invested in an Indonesian budget carrier.
We're seeing an upgrade from low income to middle income. People have grown their businesses. They demand more travel to see their children, to see their parents, and so forth.
Fierce price competition means good deals too. Even international flights in the region can cost as little as $20. By the end of this year, there will be 50 budget carriers operating in Asia, from Malaysia's Air Asia to Indonesia's Lion Air to Cebu Pacific in the Philippines. Concor Fiatus is the vice president of Citylink, another Indonesian airline.
We need to be probably adding 70 to 80 aircraft a year. We're basically catering to a natural underlying growth that we predict in the market going forward.
Asia's airports are getting bigger and noisier. Budget airlines have grown from almost nothing 10 years ago to 25% of the Asia-Pacific aviation market today. In Jakarta, Indonesia, I'm Nidhi Dutt for Marketplace.
Now to Malaysia, where an Australian company called Lynas has built a rare earth mineral factory. It's the largest outside of China. But the factory remains closed as local activists protest. From Malaysia, Jamie York reports.
Despite their name, rare earth metals are common, and they're essential for virtually all high-tech devices, from cell phones to wind turbines to missile guidance systems. But 95% of rare earths are refined solely in China. So the new refinery is great news, says Tracy Wislosky, an analyst at Rare Metal Blog.
We want to see prices in the rare earth sector that are not going to fluctuate the way they have the last 2 years every time the Chinese decide to change their export numbers.
But many Malaysians are opposed to the new refinery. Another recent protest brought some 4,000 people to the beach here in Kuantan, a city of some 70,000 on Malaysia's east coast, just a few miles from the new refinery. Refining rare earths produces low-level radioactive waste, and Lynas has no approved plan for the storage of that waste. Member of Parliament Fuzaiah Saleh says the refinery doesn't make sense for this community.
It's owned by Australians 100%. It only provides 350 jobs. I don't see the benefits. There's so much risk. We get the honor of being a dumping ground for the radioactive waste, and we will not accept that.
Malaysians know this waste problem all too well. The last refinery that operated outside of China was in Malaysia. It closed 20 years ago, and after $100 million is still being decontaminated. Researchers and physicians saw a spike in leukemia and birth defects. The victims have never been compensated. Many Malaysians are deeply skeptical that their government has learned from the past, but Lynas CEO Nick Curtis says that his refinery is cleaner, and in fact, it's Malaysia's past that drew him here.
We felt there was a silver lining. Malaysia had built off the back of that era a body of regulation and a body of approval processes which was as good as anywhere in the world.
Opponents have vowed to continue fighting. They say if you want a steady supply of rare earths, take on the risk and reap the rewards where regulations are strict and the process is more transparent. In Malaysia, I'm Jamie York for Marketplace.
Back on Groundhog Day, we asked a couple of economists to play groundhog and predict the economic future, shadow or no shadow. Well, today we asked them to do it again. First up, Charles Ballard. He's an econ professor at Michigan State University.
On Groundhog Day, I thought there were some shadows, but actually I thought it was a pretty good chance that we would have a good spring, and in fact we have. The U.S. economy has added well over 600,000 jobs in that time, and in fact the last 7 months have seen the most employment growth in the U.S. since late 2005 and early 2006. So really, I think Punxsutawney Phil did not see his shadow. I think it's been a pretty good spring.
And Richard DeKayser with the Parthenon Group.
We're looking at mostly sunny skies, certainly not completely sunny. The Eurozone area, threats of confrontation in the Middle East, and U.S. fiscal policy is eventually going to have to be dealt with, even though not right now.
Jack Ablin is chief investment officer at Harris Private Bank.
I'd say partly cloudy, but I do think that notwithstanding the problems in Europe, I think the growth in the U.S. will help propel world growth this year.
And Tara Sinclair at the George Washington University.
We're going to continue to see some glimmers of a true springtime, followed by continued concerns about what's going on in Europe and their joint problems of struggles with austerity and trying to stimulate their economies while still trying to deal with government debt. And we're going to see similar patterns here in the U.S.
If you want to join in with your own economic predictions, tweet us at MKT Place Radio or find us online at marketplace.org. Today is Memorial Day. It's a day to think about the less than 1% of Americans who serve in uniform and those who've died in the line of duty. Today, we wanted to take a look at ways to support our servicemen and women and their families. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
When a soldier dies in combat, there's a huge emotional toll for the family, and the financial impact can be overwhelming. If you're looking for a charity to support, Jason Hansman with the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America has a recommendation.
TAP, Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, is one of the premier organizations that is working with families of the fallen to kind of make sure that they're taken care of.
Then there's the issue of helping vets provide for themselves. Unemployment among veterans runs as high as 30% in some parts of the country. Joe Davis is spokesman for the Veterans of Foreign Wars.
A pat on the back is one thing, but helping veterans to get jobs when they take off the uniform and try to reimmerse themselves back into civilian society, a job is crucial.
Wall Street is hiring. Chris Perkins is a former Marine captain and now a managing director at Citibank. He says many people in human resources don't realize that an artillery officer might make a good stock market trader.
These guys are making quantitative decisions all day long and understanding risk, and it's very, very similar between the military and finance.
The former Marine captain helped establish an alliance called Veterans on Wall Street. It helps vets find jobs in finance, even if they only have a high school education.
Many of our jobs, in fact, hundreds of our jobs, do not require college degrees.
Perkins says Citibank plans to hire at least 1,000 vets this year. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Memorial Day can be a solemn holiday, but it's also a day to hang out at home, maybe light up the barbecue. And for retailers, it's the beginning of the summer buying season. Shannon Mullen explains why.
It has a lot to do with the weather. Temperatures are rising, and consumers are looking for everything from new bathing suits to barbecue grills.
From your basic charcoal grill
To your smokers, if you're going to spend 4 hours making some ribs for yourself. And then,
Mike McCusker is manager at a Target store north of Boston.
I think this is the time that people start thinking vacation for the summer. You start to see a real difference in buying patterns from this weekend right through Labor Day weekend.
A lot of stores use promotions to move leftovers from the slower winter months, and consumers are easy targets on long holiday weekends.
Retailers have done a really good job of enticing those people who might have off work.
Kathy Granis is with the National Retail Federation.
You know, and if you've already done, you know, the traveling or the picnics and there's not much left on your agenda, I think consumers look to shopping maybe now more than ever as a part of these three-day holiday weekends.
Granis says retailers don't report Memorial Day sales figures separately from the rest of May. But thanks to Mother's Day and graduation season, this turns out to be one of their best months of the year. In Boston, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
However you celebrate or commemorate, enjoy the holiday. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.